Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College presents Liberty Mail with the student fellows of Faith and Freedom.
Welcome back to Liberty Mail. I'm Aaron Jenks, and we are here in the underground studio at Grove City College representing the Institute for Faith and Freedom. Here at Liberty Mail today, we have a special episode with visiting interviewer Isaac Willauer. And Isaac is on a number of things. He's been already on the podcast once. If you haven't checked out that, please look at that. But currently, he's the chair of the American Enterprise Institute here at Grove City College. He's written more than 100 national bylines, ranging from the Dispatch Right to the National Review.
Yep.
Man, tell me if I'm missing anything. I think there's also the Collegian you work for here
yep,
at campus.
Absolutely. I'm a contributor at the Acton Institute as well.
Yeah, so he gets his hands dirty, and hopefully we got some increasing in the Institute for Faith and Freedom coming year.
Guess we'll find out, but thanks for having me back. This is great.
Yeah, thanks for coming on today. And so basically, Isaac and I were kind of brainstorming over the past, I'd say, since last episode, maybe a couple months, maybe a new episode, but Isaac reached out to me, and we've definitely touched on this theme of, okay, look at Gen Z in our age group, look at maybe even including millennials, we look at the 18 to 30-something-year-old, and we look, okay, well, why is this two generations, or specifically our generation, so much different?
Yeah, for sure. It's the quintessential question that's hitting everyone trying to do political marketing right now, is that we have these two groups that are on par to be, by the end of the decade, the biggest voting bloc in America. And there's a lot of stereotypes about that voting bloc, and we can get into some of that. But the question is, what do we do about that, this biggest voting bloc in America that isn't particularly conservative? How do we talk to those people? How do we create some kind of pathway to effectively market to those people? And I think we can't have either of those questions without actually talking about what is that voting bloc? What are their experiences? What's shaped them into being this very, very odd generational group of people? So I think these are all questions that are really worth answering. It's going to be super interesting to get into them today.
Yeah, and I want to start off with, like, you have the stereotypes, and then there before the stereotypes, there's even, okay, this generation is voting, if we look at the past couple midterms.
For sure, in record numbers.
Yeah, the proportion or percentage of our generation and the millennials, it's ridiculous. Do you have the numbers?
I don't have direct numbers, but in terms of overall participation, the 2018 midterms saw ridiculously high turnout from Generation Z and pretty similarly from millennials.
I can remember the headlines.
Was the second. Yeah, exactly.
It was the top story for a couple weeks.
Exactly, because it's weird, right? Because the conventional wisdom, and there's actually going to be a fair bit of shattering of conventional wisdom here, but the stereotypes are young people don't vote.
Yeah.
And they're too busy, like, playing on the smartphones, which we can get into the smartphone thing, and I'm sure we will. But, yeah, this group of generational young people, our generation, turns out to vote. Does that mean they know what they're voting about? Not necessarily. Does it mean they understand the consequences? As we'll see, not always.
And so then come really the stereotypes that you see. You don't quite see on social media, I'd say. You see it more coming from traditional media outlets, either the cable news or online publications.
Yeah, we see it in traditional media spaces that are populated by non-Gen Z people talking about Gen Z, right? So you can get to, like, you can just run down laundry list of some of the stereotypes. We're addicted to our phones.
Yeah, you start with the tech addict.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, the stereotype is, you know, you see the kid in Walmart who's, like, 8 running around on their cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the iPad kid, exactly, right? We're tech addicted. We're the safe space generation, right? We can't handle stress. We can't handle conflict. And some of this is – obviously, some of that is true, right? You go on conservative social media, you see videos of these protests at universities and stuff like that. That reinforces this stereotype about we're a generation of safe spaces. We can't handle disagreement. We brand everything we don't like as intolerant. Yeah, and these are all – I don't think – well, here, let's start here. I think the way you can accurately summarize all these things is in one word, snowflake, right? Gen Z is stereotypically the snowflake generation. So here's the thing. Calling Gen Z snowflakes is the least helpful thing you can possibly do ever. Because not only does it introduce an air of derision into this conversation, but it also means we're just writing this group off. We're taking the biggest generational voting block in America and we're writing it off as a bunch of snowflakes that aren't worth reaching. Well, you can do that, but it's not helpful. Like, I'm sorry, I'm part of Generation Z, you're part of Generation Z. We have to find a way to talk to these people. Because not only are they on par to be the biggest voting block in American history, but, you know, I know, we all know, people's voting preferences get settled very early in life. Like, a lot of people who vote Democrat now vote Democrat because they've been voting Democrat for the past 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It's really, really hard to change those. So we need to hit this hard now before those voting preferences get completely ingrained. Because if we don't do it, then America's biggest voting bloc is going to be consistently Democratic for 40, 50 years. Do we want that? Not really.
Mm-hmm. I will say that maybe in our circles that we see it just coming from the right, kind of pushing down and then maybe even labeling them as a snowflake generation. But I think it's good. And in my own practice, I follow a bunch of more left pages. Mm-hmm. And, man, they see it pushing up from older Democrats just as much.
Yeah.
So there's this rebellious feeling within Gen Z. And as we said, okay, they're going to lean to the left a little bit more. And then even with the millennials. But they all kind of, I think, have this understanding that from above there is this, okay, they're getting put down a couple of steps.
Yeah, and I think that gets into kind of the slightly different moral issue of talking about how to reach Gen Z isn't just a neat political strategy, although it is a political strategy. It's a very vital one. Like, Gen Z are, they're our colleagues. They're our friends. They're our relatives in many cases. They're our fellow Americans in all of these cases. Ignoring them is not an act of love.
Mm-hmm.
And, right? And treating them as monolithic is not an act of love.
Yeah.
We can do better than that, and we absolutely have to.
And it's sad to see it coming on both sides, pushing them down. Or even I've experienced myself, and I'm sure you have in your work being a journalist. And so it kind of leads me, though, to the optimistic side where there is this hope as, okay, young conservatives, or even working with older conservatives, there is a path where, okay, they're not won over completely in my mind yet. But what dictates their policy, I think, so much is the social aspect of America. It has so little to do with, I think we were talking about earlier, you had that it's everyday issues.
Yeah, it's broadly issue-focused, mm-hmm. and it's broadly issue-focused with a very abstract appeal, right? We're fighting for justice. We're fighting for social justice. We're fighting to right radical inequality. These are the phrases that Gen Z largely uses to talk about politics, and that doesn't mean that everyone in Gen Z is just committed to this very broad and kind of ambiguous conception of justice, but it does mean those are the terms that we talk in.
Mm-hmm. And I can hear almost in my mind, like, someone in their 40s or someone saying, well, that's so annoying and frustrating. Mm-hmm. Like, why can't – they're going to understand maybe down the road, or why can't they just understand right now?
Right.
That's not how it works.
It is annoying and frustrating to a point, but at the same time, like, okay.
Well, yeah. I'm going to say I'm sympathetic to it because I think the millennials especially, and then even us so much – grew up in school with, okay, big ideas were a part of our education, I think, so much, and just talking about American
sure.
idealism. And so I think the argument from the millennials is, okay, this idealism isn't working in America, so we're going to take this and try to push it our own way.
Yeah, it's kind of this pendulum swing from a dissatisfaction in American promises.
Mm.
And in some ways, that dissatisfaction is completely justified. But at the same time, we have to find a way to still argue for – I mean, the way we teased this when we were talking about this episode is this question of how do we sell conservative values to highly engaged, moderately informed, and barely connected people?
I think that's well put, yeah.
That's a weird group to try and market to. How do we do that? Especially when our message is one of being engaged, but also being highly informed, and especially on being highly connected.
Mm.
How do we sell that to people who are just completely not born and raised to be like that? Well, that takes a really holistic strategy.
So we talked about kind of why this matters going forward. We talked about the implications of the voting bloc going
yeah.
forward. And I mean, that's super important just for policy's sake in our lifetime. But then what do you – this was an interesting idea you had. You talked about with me the post 9/11 generation and
mm-hmm.
how that kind of shapes the kind of the dogma surrounding maybe what they view as social
yeah.
rhetoric or anything.
There's a really interesting test that you can do with people who – especially with people who aren't your age about this. But my – this is a very, very broad theory. But my thought partially on this is not only are we post 9/11, most of Gen Z is post 9/11.
Mm.
Every person in Gen Z, regardless of how you count the generation – that's another problem, but we won't hit that right now. Everybody in Gen Z knows what it is like to grow up in the uncertainty of post 9/11 America, right? That's a big thing. It's an event. It's an event of significance. So I'm gonna ask you, because I'm actually curious about this.
Go for it.
I think when you ask someone what their first event of significance are, it actually tells you a fair bit of how they approach the world. So politically, what is the first event that you remember? Like, you were old enough to actually realize what was happening and quantify your own reaction to it. It doesn't matter how old you were. What was the first political event that you remember in that way?
I can't put a name to it, but it I'll say two things, actually, because the one that is, like, stuck in my memory just from watching the news is one of the school shootings. It might have been Sandy Hook, but I can't remember completely, or Columbine.
Might have been Columbine.
But yeah. The one where I can, like, where I think I was more informed about everything was the market crash of 08. And then also with the bank bailout.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two most specific things, I think, in my mind as a 22-year-old popped to mind. How about you?
Exactly. So for me, it's the election of Barack Obama.
Okay.
Right? And so, but it was the election of Barack Obama being raised in a conservative household, which is not as much of the hope-filled, everything is possible way that a lot of people saw the election of Barack Obama, right? But my thought is, you mentioned the bank, you mentioned the recession, talked about the election of Barack Obama, all these things. Our events of significance for Gen Z are largely connected to political polarization. So you remember the bank bailout. You remember the political polarization that swirled around that. If the first event you remember is the election of Barack Obama, you definitely remember the political polarization that went along with that. For a lot of people who weren't as like politically engaged growing up the first thing people remember is the election of Donald Trump. Like, that's the first thing they consciously paid attention to in politics. And you talk to people who are older, and the first thing they remember is the Berlin Wall or Nixon or something like that. And I think that affects how we look at it, because our political cognitions are born to a world of political uncertainty and polarization. So no wonder we're like this. That's my thought.
So it sounds like you're pretty certain on that this event of let's take the younger generation of Gen Z and the election of Donald Trump then. You take any kind of rising political groups out of that election, and then you see, I think you're committing so much to the younger generation that's going to be brand them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, well, you're setting the parameters through which you view politics. Mm. So let's just say, hypothetically, the first political event you remember is the election of Donald Trump. Do you remember the country being particularly happy after that happened? Not particularly. Do you see the country being particularly happy as a result of that now? Probably not. And you can make the same argument about the election of Barack Obama, or about the recession, or even push it back, you know, the war on terror. You can make the same arguments there.
Mm.
People are not happy in America, and that lack of happiness is dividing very strongly along partisan lines. And so that affects our youngest generation, because we were born into that. That's what we know. That's how we quantify the world. And so this is part of the reason. There was an interesting article a while ago about this, about how Generation Z and millennials aren't becoming more conservative as they get older. And this can kind of segue into some of the more practical issues about media and faith and life and all these kinds of things. Generation Z and millennials aren't becoming more conservative. Why? Part of that is because they're not actually – their life philosophies are not inherently conservative. But the other reason is because they – for a variety of reasons, we can get into some of these. I think a lot of Generation Z has been conditioned really to not like conservatives. They've been conditioned with some very, very bad messages about who conservatives are, what conservatives stand for.
Well, let me stop you real quick, because to the effect that, okay, one event is going to have such a dramatic impact on how this individual views, it's hard for me to kind of put some data behind that. I understand the kind of the implications of it, but what I've been kind of reading, looking into this subject, and then also I listened to a podcast, can't remember for the life of me what it was, but that, okay, our generation is – more than maybe the past generations, is constantly fed large events in sequence. So it kind of builds up the feel.
You're also being fed highly negative news coverage every angle.
I was going to say, yeah, so leading into that, then the majority of that is kind of negative. And then I think both you and I would agree that the majority of it is leaning to the left for these younger generations. That are on social media for the majority of their news.
And even the right-wing content, a lot of the right-wing content that people are being
also
fed
is
very negative and very anti-left. Mm-hmm. So what you can get from that, and I just want to be clear, well, I'm not saying that the single political event, the first political event you remember, completely shapes indelibly the core of how you view politics. I am saying that it does have an impact. Because the way you respond to that is probably the way you're going to respond to every single next political thing that happens, unless you do some serious thinking about it, and most people don't. So that's my thought. Mm. And so when you're fed that constant media diet,
I think it's fair.
Yeah, you're going to have a fairly combative view of the world, and you're going to, in many cases, you're going to see the world as a battle between good people and bad people. Which read all about that in Jonathan Haidt's The Coddling of the American Mind, but that's a different subject. But I think that's, when we look at Generation Z, that's what we see, is a generation's comfortable, not comfortable with, is accustomed to political polarization, and yet still sees the reasons for this political polarization as legitimate.
So here's a question to you. So then where do you see the messaging differ to where the Democrats pull in such, I would say pull in so much more, pull in a greater majority of our generation with almost, it seems after this conversation that both sides are being equally as negative, or if one is being more than the other.
Yeah, I think, what do you sell to people who are really, really accustomed to negativity? What do you sell? Do you sell them more negativity? If you want to actually create some kind of meaningful change, whether that's voting a certain way, buying a certain thing, what do you have to sell those people? You have to sell them something different. You have to sell them something actually ideological. Basically, you have to sell them a why, right? And Democrat messaging does a really good job of selling why. We'll take a hypothetical. Why do you believe in abortion access? The key to political messaging, in my opinion anyway, is to argue for people and not against things. And this is where Democrat messaging is really, really good. Go back to Obama. He was for hope and change. He wasn't against Republicans. You can make the case that he was, in point of fact, very against Republicans, and that's true. But that's not what his messaging told you. So let's take a Democrat messaging strategy. Why are we pro-abortion? If we're using the for people advertising strategy that works on Gen Z, and works on a lot of people for what it's worth. We are for abortion because we are fighting for the reproductive health of women, of marginalized people, of communities of color. We are fighting for all those things because we believe in their worth. Now, let's go with the against things. We are against bills that cut abortion access for women. Mm. Which one of those is more persuasive to you? It's probably the first one. Because you're being sold a message of, if you vote this way, if you care about this issue in the way that I care about this issue, you are a compassionate person. You care about the health of women and minorities, communities of color, and marginalized people. That's the messaging that's been sold to Generation Z by Democrats en masse, and it's worked.
Now, do you see a breakdown between the major political parties selling that message and then where you, let's look into social rooms and social bubbles, as you said, and spaces, where you see accounts of garnering 800,000 followers on a TikTok account. And in my opinion, they do not push that same message. Or at least they, if I had to put a number to it, I guess, they maybe push that message that is similar to the party 30% of the time. And then 70% of the time, they also push the, let's attack this other side. Let's think of people and not focus on our own message.
Yeah, so here's the question, I think, comes down to, what do you actually want people to do when you talk to them politically? What's the end goal of political messaging? Is it to get people to think a certain way, or is it to get them to do a certain thing? Right? So let's just take a typical example. We are against socialism. We are against Marxism. We are against woke, big government, democratic socialism. Some amalgamation of those words on a social media infographic.
That you I'm see sure it on an Instagram post.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, there you go.
Right? What does that do? What do you walk away from the Instagram post thing, if it works, which is already a shot in the dark, but if it works, you walk away thinking, man, socialism's really bad. Mm. You see Bernie Sanders talking about, we're fighting for workers' rights. We're fighting against corrupt capitalism that screws the worker and keeps their pay low and is fighting against them and is making sure they can't put food on their table. My policies are fighting for that. Support my policies. You come away from that saying, man, the plight of those workers is really something. We need to actually do something about that. Because now I've attached a face to this issue, right? I'm not against socialism. I'm fighting for people. I'm fighting for workers. That messaging works better. If you want people to do things, if you want people to think stuff, you can get a lot of people to think stuff.
And I think that applies so broadly to our generation because, I mean, just from working, like, doing man on the streets for over the past 2 years.
Yeah. The thing that works for Gen Z political activism people, is taking thinking stuff and turning it into doing things.
Well, yes, but I was going to say, so many people in our generation, I think above two, just don't care so much as you and I. You have
about
those,
politics?
Yeah, you have super devoted individuals. And I think almost maybe, like, hyper-focused and hyper-devoted I don't know, compared to another generation or so, but you people stand out when they are so devoted to politics.
Yeah, there's a reason Gen Z is known as the activist generation.
Mm-hmm. But then so many, on a large portion, like you said, see that messaging, and I agree to you a point where, okay, they're going to say, which one is correct when I walk away from, okay, Sanders is talking about well, we do need to help these workers. But then the Instagram post I just saw showed me the deaths of millions under socialists 50 years ago.
Sure. And that works. And this is why the activists in Gen Z, and there are a lot of activists in Gen Z, I've met many of them. Many of them are legitimately decent people who just have some really bad ideas. But at the end of the day, they believe that they're doing the correct thing. They believe that they're fighting for people. And therefore, it's going to be way harder to dissuade them by just saying, well, socialism sucks. Okay. Maybe socialism does suck, but what are you doing for people? What are we doing for people? How can we convince people that they're – like racism is a classic example, right? Like we'll take reparations, right? California just released this reparations proposal, which I have not read, so I'm not going to give any specifics on that because I don't want to talk about something I haven't read. Are we anti-reparations? Is that the message that conservatives need to send? That we're anti-reparations? Is that something that's going to resonate with Gen Z? Or is it going to be more helpful to essentially say – we believe that reparations are not the way to win for millions of impoverished people in this country because anti-reparations policies only help one group of impoverished people based on their skin color. And that is not fighting for everybody. That is not fighting for the poor. That is fighting for a racially subdivided subset of the poor. That's not justice. And we're not and that's not us fighting for all poor Americans. Which one of those is more persuasive?
And then which one gets heard, though? Because I understand that is, in my mind, that's more persuasive and as the more gentle kind of tongue in the conversation. But does that get the clicks? I wish there would be some data behind that, too.
Yeah. And part of it is we don't do it all that often.
That's also true, yeah.
Yeah.
There are certain individuals, I'd say, that you see throughout Instagram or TikTok that do, and they garner quite a committed following, I'd say. They're... interactions on comments are up, their likes are up.
For sure.
If you want to break it down and analyze it like that. But their message, it's purposeful and it's also understanding the other side and seeing why that their other side is so motivating to so many people in our generation.
Well,
and
that's then the other thing.
Pushing towards our own kind of solution.
For sure. Because selling a message of being against things can generate a lot of anger and it can generate some, it'll probably generate some voting potential, at least for a little bit. But you're not building the undergirding philosophy, it's actually going to keep those people, right? Why do you think Generation Z votes Democrat overwhelmingly? Like, just throw out, like, an idea.
Well,
I'd
mostly just put it towards, we talked about it on the podcast, Grace and I, where I think you have a lot of individuals who really care about big ideas, as in equal justice. And I mean, I also care about that from even Christian perspective. And you have individuals who care about, they've seen the horrors of racism in the past and they want to work towards a unified America. And so they're the only kind of people I think pushing out that message have been, like we said, Democrats on large scale. You have individuals on the right who also do that, but I'd say on large scale, the Republicans aren't as qualified, or not qualified, aren't as...
they're not as present in those messaging debates. And look, none of this is to say that the Democratic positions on race or on reparations policy or on, you know, government redistribution of wealth, socialist-y stuff, is not to say that any of those positions are necessarily correct. They're not. But if we're not willing to take a person-centric view of messaging, then we are going to lose Gen Z. Because Gen Z cares about personal relationships and they care about big issues, and they care about feeling. We care about feeling like we're good people.
I think on a human nature scale, we care about having hope.
Yeah,
towards moving towards something
for sure
that is better. And that's harder, I'd say, for some conservatives because I mean, even if you think about it, because you think of it so much. Okay, well, we want progress, but we want it to come with prudence and with the ability to analyze a situation and think of every negative that can happen from it and be very analytical about it. But then I'd say a lot of people in our generation just are tired of that. We don't have time for that is kind of the argument of the climate change.
This is exactly right. There's vulnerable ecosystems that need our help. Why are we sitting around discussing the data on what policies work? And
to you and I, the policy or discussing the analytics behind it sounds
that's
super
fun,
logical.
Right, and it makes sense because we need to figure out the best policy to solve this problem because we're against the Green New Deal and all of these things that don't actually help.
Well, let me put this towards you then. You have, I think, so many in our generation that, okay, they just put change into effect And not just for the sake of change. They think it's really going to be purposeful and helpful. And then there's also this desire to use the government as the arm mm-hmm. of that change. And so how does the conservative movement react to that with putting forward our own message and putting forward a plan of solutions? But does that involve the government in your mind going forward? Or is yeah. that, 'cause I think that's a... They have to come to terms with that.
Yeah, I mean, at some level, it does have to involve the government in some fashion, right? But in terms of social issues, I think the real struggle with this when it comes to reaching Generation Z is that what's the alternative to government programs? Social programs. What do social programs require? Community. What is Generation Z less plugged into than every generation that came before it, came before us? Social community. That's wild, right? And if you want to sell Gen Z on non-government solutions, you have to be willing to take the practical steps to help them realize the value of non-governmental institutions because they haven't been raised to in many cases, which means we need to find a way to sell Gen Z on church. We need to find a way to sell Gen Z on community involvement and volunteering. And we have to make the case for those things because there is no inherent case for those for a generation that grew up socially isolated, using technology more than any generation that came before it, and has just lived through a COVID pandemic that has given us even greater sense of social isolation. We need to find ways to sell Generation Z on those things because it's really hard to make arguments for non-governmental solutions to stuff if government's the only thing that you've ever seen is providing for you.
Mm. And in your mind, you see, like, is it clear to you or is there a path that is clear bringing them that message of the community and the positives
yeah,
that come from?
There's a positive and a negative side to this, right? There's the positive, we can make a case now, and we can try and, even as active members of Gen Z, we mm-hmm. can try and invest in those communities, right? We can invest in church, we can do community service and volunteering, that type of thing. But at the same time, like, the negative prediction is in 5 to 10 to 20 years, there's going to be a massive block of Gen Zers in this country who are absolutely broken and burned out by the consequences of living a life devoid of any community that's not an iPhone screen. And we're going to have to take those people in. And we're going to have to take in a lot of very broken people. And it's an imperative labor of love to do those things. And maybe that makes them more conservative. Maybe it doesn't. But this is the generation that we are. We're very connection low. We're very politically engaged. We care deeply about justice and we care a lot about kindness. As long as those things look exactly the way that we think they should. That's a really difficult audience to market anything to. Mm. Especially something like conservatism that involves timeless values. And that's the fight. And there are a lot of different ways to do it. But we have to fight for people. We can't just fight against things. And we have to just be very comfortable with the fact that this is a long battle.
I agree. And I think to kind of wrap it up is as a Christian conservative, you struggle maybe with, okay, well, how do I work within this political landfield or
minefield,
garbage dump?
Maybe.
Yeah. And how do I navigate, okay, well, I need to be smart about getting the voting block. I need to advertise and market correctly. But then, like you said, if it does come down in 5-10 years, the Christian role and what it calls us to do is, like you said, bring them in lovingly.
Yeah. Everything we're doing is about
love. We'll handle the politics to the side.
Yeah. Everything we're doing here about finding a way to reach Gen Z, finding a way to teach them about the institutions that actually create meaning, all these things are labors of love because we have to love our neighbor, and this is what loving your neighbor looks like. And it's weird, and for people who aren't Gen Z, it probably looks a little bit strange. It feels like tech-obsessed and weird. Yeah, it is all those things, but it's the world we have. Mm. And the call to love our neighbor hasn't changed. Now
I don't think you need to be the wild activist with 100,000 followers on Instagram. I think it starts with just, like you said, working like you do, working like I do. Go and get your job in D.C. and just work within 20, have a group of 20 people that you slowly...
Yeah, we're imperfect people who have a divine call to love our neighbor, trying to do our best.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to wrap it up with that. Thank you, Isaac, so much for the conversation today. Anyone else listening right now, please check out the episode before. I think it was 2 months ago. And that was also a very good conversation. But like and subscribe as always. Follow us if you're on Wow.
All the social media platforms.
Yeah.
Find them.
Spotify was the one that I wanted to come into my head. But thank you for the sale, Isaac, and thank you for coming in today.
Dude, thanks so much.
For more information on the Institute for Faith and Freedom